but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Well, Brandon O'Meara is the author of the book, The Front Runner. Are we going to get him on the phone here? I am assuming that we are going to get the guest on the phone as we are coming back from break here. Stephen Vaughn, Steve Prefontaine, 50-year anniversary of Pre's death coming up. Book coming out in conjunction with that. Just waiting for the phone screener to get the guest on the show. Did the phone screener not know we were in commercial break? Brandon O'Meara is our author, Eugene-based journalist. He's written a book about Steve Prefontaine. It's out in 6 days. It's called The Front Runner, The Life of Steve Prefontaine, and Brandon O'Meara joining us now. Hey, thanks for joining us. I appreciate you, man.
Hey, John, I am super happy to be with you and your listeners, and got to say, great column there on the Youth League coaches the other day. I really loved it.
Thank you. Thanks, man. It's got me all fired up. I'm all kinds of fired up about it because it just shouldn't be happening, but that'll be your next book. Let's have you do a book on youth sports and where we've lost our way. How about that? give me an idea. The Front Runner comes out here on May 20th. Life of Steve Prefontaine. What kind of pushed you in this direction?
Well, several years ago, I was thinking about a lot of, you know, we were really starting to interrogate a lot of our statues, you know, and across the country. And I was thinking, well, there's really no bigger statue in Oregon than Prefontaine. And it was starting to nudge up against the 50th anniversary of his passing. And so it really got me thinking of maybe it was time to reappraise his life and cast him in a new modern light, given that we've had decades to really digest his life and get perspective on it. And so a few years ago, about 3 years ago at this point, I really knew I was coming up against that anniversary. And it really was the timing was right. And nothing new and fresh had really been done on him in decades. So that gave me a chance to kind of move in and try to cover a new turf and try to get to the man behind the myth.
This is a guy, obviously, with deep ties in the state of Oregon, Steve Prefontaine. Coos Bay, he's born there. Tragically, at the age of 24, he dies. I've been up to Pre's Rock. And, you know, it's interesting. During the Prefontaine Classic years and years ago, I sat up by the rock and just wrote a column about all the people who were coming to visit it and the cult-like, figure that Prefontaine cast. And as you do the reporting and the work on this book, Brandon, you know, what did you learn about Pre that maybe surprised you?
Well, I really found him to be a far more tender and sensitive human being than maybe he's been portrayed in the media, be it in movies or the documentary, the sort of Nike documentary Fire on the Track that came out in the mid-90s. And yeah, he was just such a really good friend, a good teammate, and something more than just the brash avatar that we've come to know from that early 70s roguish iconoclastic figure. And so it was great to cover new ground and get a sense of maybe what forged him as an athlete, shine new light on some of his unsung coaches. You know, he's so tied to Bowerman, but his ties to Walt McClure and Phil Persian from Marshfield High School in Coos Bay run so deep, and they were so formative. And it was really an exercise in getting beyond the brash, cocky facade that he's been sort of a one note kind of runner in personality, and to really bring him back to his humanity and remind people that he was a spectacularly charismatic person and a good friend, athlete, teammate, fraternity brother. Everything that you come to know from maybe someone in their young 20s. And so getting burrowing below that mythology and beyond the legend was a great exercise, and had a real fun time learning more about him and getting more to his core.
I'm interested in kind of how he found running, because the perception that we'd all have is that he started off as a runner and was great to start with, but that's not the case. How did Steve Prefontaine find distance running and cross country running, and then eventually the track?
Yeah, because the sporting culture in Coos Bay was, and I think to this day is, but certainly back in the 60s when he was coming up, was huge. It was how you earned status. Like when I talked to one of his friends, Roger Bingham, you know, he said you could either be, you know, really smart or really popular in Coos Bay, or you could be an athlete. And if you could be an athlete, you could be somebody. And so for the early part of Steve's adolescence, he was really exploring, like trying to find a sense of belonging. And he was too small to play football, though he tried. He was too short to play basketball. But eventually he started, you know, at one point he confessed to McClure at one point that he looked across and saw people running, and he just thought it was crazy. He's like, who would run all day? Like, that's insane. But eventually he locked into that, and he found a bit of a talent for it. He wasn't the world beater we all kind of knew him to be eventually. But eventually he found an aptitude for it, and the more he leaned into it, the better he got. And he did find that sense of belonging that he so desperately craved. And turns out the more he worked, the more he pushed himself, the better and better he got until he was a national star.
Yeah, I was looking back at like kind of his freshman and sophomore years of high school. Like, you know, he ran a 5-minute mile his first year, but that was like, he was like the seventh guy. He was 53rd in the state championships by the end of his freshman and sophomore years. He didn't qualify for the state meet. And so it wasn't really till his sophomore year where he kind of found it, and he's training under Walt McClure, and he really gets out and works hard. Do you have a sense of what the trigger was for Pre?
Yeah. So his sophomore year, he's starting to get better. He's training with his friend Tom Huggins, who is one of the better upperclassmen on the team, just a year ahead of Steve. In spring track season, sophomore year, he had run during the season a state qualifying time in the 2-mile. But in districts, when it mattered, he failed to qualify for states. And in fact, the entire Coos Bay team didn't qualify a single distance runner for states. And that gnawed at him. And he came back that summer for early training, and he pulls Walt McClure and Phil Persian aside, and they're setting goals, and they ask him what he wanted to do. And he's like, I'm going to be state champion in cross country and spring track. And they kind of look at each other like, okay, well, all right, whatever. And, you know, Steve goes away, and the coaches look at each other, and they're like, well, that's awfully ambitious. I don't know if he can do it this year. But they drew up a plan, and Steve set it in his mind that he wanted to do that. And he was kind of on the vanguard of this visualization. And he set it in his mind that he was going to be a state champ. And sure enough, in that fall and in that spring, he became state champ. And in cross country, it was when he won – and this is in Salem at Bush Pasture, I believe — the photograph of him winning might be the most honest and raw portrait of him that's ever been taken. Mm. Because he is in absolute shock that he won. He was apoplectic that he had won. And we've come to see him cross finish line first dozens and dozens and dozens of times, and it's almost matter of fact. But that was the first time he was a champion, and he couldn't believe it himself. So it was really not qualifying for state his sophomore year that set his mind and his focus onto greater things.
We're talking to Brendan O'Meara. He's written a book about Steve Prefontaine. It coincides with the 50th anniversary of Pre's death, May 30th, 1975. The book's called Front Runner, The Life of Steve Prefontaine. Did you get cooperation from the family? You know, how open arms were they as you start to try to do the story? And you know, do you find resistance, or are people really wanting to talk about Pre?
I would say 99.9% of people were very happy to talk. My first email was to his sister, and she didn't want to participate. You know, over the years, a lot of people have knocked on her door to write about her brother and everything, and I respected her not wanting to cooperate. But as a journalist, at that point, you just start, you widen the circle, you widen the net, and you start making the calls after calls. And you find all the big names, of course, you know, the Frank Shorters of the world, the Ralph Manns. But then you start, you look at an article from the Coos Bay World where, you know, you find when before Steve was a before he was beating everybody, there might be a guy named Greg Barnett out of Roseburg who beat him. And turns out, like, I was able to track down Greg, who's never spoken about Steve his whole life, but he had a little slice of his own memory of Steve. And you start triangulating by calling all these people, and through hundreds of interviews, you can really round out the whole. Even if you don't have central cooperation from maybe the estate or the people right at the heart of it, but you widen that net and you call and call and call and call, and you really get a sense of a person's character, and you can build him out from there.
Steve Prefontaine dies at the age of 24. The Eugene Register Guard called it the end of an era in the news story. And yet, I look at NIL, I look at the transfer portal, I look at his spirit and kind of the questions he was raising even back, you know, at that time, and I go, gosh, he would have been at the forefront. He would have been one of these former college athletes that would have been out here banging the drum saying, yes, athletes should have been paid, they should have been compensated. You know, what do you make of kind of the spirit that he had along those lines?
It's great that you bring that up, because the original subtitle of the book was The Dawn of the Modern Athlete. And he was so ahead of his time in terms of what we might call brand building today. He was so conscientious of his image and how he portrayed himself in the media as a character and as a magnet for great copy. And it put him out on the forefront, and it allowed to elevate a runner's and an athlete's celebrity that you just didn't see in track and field. And the degree to which he was championing athlete empowerment and pushing up against the amateur structures of the day, which didn't allow an amateur athlete so much as to coach track and field, let alone earn a buck from it. And so he was challenging the AAU. He was the face of a very young Nike. And 73-ish is when the spikes were up to his standard and it would start to run in them and compete in them. And yeah, he just, he organized a series of athlete sanctioned events in Oregon that started Madras, where he brought over a cohort of Finnish athletes, which was supposed to include Lasse Virran, the 1972 5K champ who had to withdraw from an injury due to an injury. But he organized this set of meets in the face of the draconian rules of the AAU. And you began to see that the amateur establishment was crumbling and turning into something wholly more professional, which would take quite a ways to fully manifest. But what we see today, we can definitely see the roots of it and the seeds of it with Prefontaine.
Our guest, Brendan O'Meara, he's written a book about Steve Prefontaine. Again, it'll be out here in about 6 days. You know, you're starting to talk about this. I don't know how many interviews you've done, but, how receptive do you think people will be to, you know, there's been movies about Pre. What sets this book apart?
I'd like to think that what people will learn, and I ran into that a lot when I would interview certain people and be like, don't we know everything there is to know about this guy? I was like, well, that was, part of the journey and part of the exploration through the research and to go read thousands and thousands of articles and go conduct hundreds of interviews to get a sense of maybe who he was in a way that maybe people have forgotten or maybe never knew in the first place, to introduce him to a new generation of people. And just over the course of that research, you realize how the mental side of things was very important to him, and how the terrorist attacks in Munich really affected him, and how he ultimately ran that race, and how it took him a long time to recover from that. I uncovered just fortuitously and serendipitously in the course of the research that he was coaching a lot of young women, young track stars of the day, a couple who still live in Eugene to this day, who have some of their notes and workouts that he drew up for them. And you really get a sense of, here was someone who was very cognizant of his image, but he, as he was maturing and after he got somewhat humbled in the Olympics, how he turned his gaze outward and to be a more service-driven person. And you realize how selfless he became just as he was reaching the height of his powers. And I hope people just get a greater understanding of who he is, instead of maybe this one coat of paint that we have come to know him over the years as just this brash sort of James Dean-ish character. There was a whole lot more going on there.
Give us an idea, because, as you start reporting here, and, we see the World Track and Field Championships, we see Hayward Field with a makeover and, one of the best venues in the world now. And, the running boom that happened, that was in the 1970s, and Runner's World magazine and the Nike uprising. How much do Steve Prefontaine, Phil Knight, and Nike sort of run hand in hand, so to speak?
Yeah, they really do. They kind of go, a question I like to ask a lot of people is like, who benefited more? Did Nike benefit more from Pre, or did Pre benefit more from Nike? And they're almost two sides of the same coin, because right at the inflection point of Nike's birth and the height of Pre's celebrity, track and field was just ready for a change. The waters were getting really brackish between the old world amateurism into what would become something more professional. There was a fledgling International Track Association, which kind of came and went in about a four-year span. But so Nike's on the rise, Pre is there, he's got that charisma, he's got the moxie, and they go hand in hand. And so as Nike's rising and Pre passes away, suddenly people start to forget about Pre, as naturally life moves on. And 20 years later, Nike in the heat of Air Jordan, the peak of Air Jordan in late 95, they really wanted to harken back to their roots. And so they kind of resurrect Prefontaine with that Fire on the Track documentary, which is kind of a brilliant piece of content marketing when you think about it. And it really lit a new flame under him and reminded people of like what a special talent this person was, robbed from us so early. And as a result, Prefontaine gets more altitude 20 years after his passing. Nike gets to harken back to its roots, which is running. And yeah, as a result, they just kind of, they're paired. And without one another, neither gains the altitude that they ultimately get at a beautiful cruising speed of 36,000 feet or so.
What's Pre doing now? If he isn't taken at the age of 24, is he a coach at Oregon? Is he working at Nike? Is he a civil rights activist? What's Pre doing now?
Yeah, he was such a magnetic person. It's hard to believe that he would be anything but an ambassador of some kind. Like a Sebastian Coe these days. He's probably never leaving Oregon. Oregon was always home, and he always was going to come back to Oregon. Like, Oregon is just his very being. And you can really imagine him just championing track and field, making sure it's accessible to younger generations, never getting priced out of a track meet. he would probably find a way to bring back the dual meets of old and get colleges competing against one another, or, you know, really infuse the sense of purpose in life into track and field and keep it very vibrant. It would have been cool to see him maybe on the road running marathon circuit and see what he might have done as that was happening in, say, like the early 80s and stuff like that. It would have been something special to think. And it's pretty to think what might have been.
You've got some events coming up about a week from now. There's a community run. There's also a book event at Cold Fire Brewing in Eugene, the craft brewery there in Eugene, on May 21st. Book comes out May 20th. Anything else you want to promote for people who are interested in this event, Brandon? Tell them how to get involved and how to find out more.
Yeah, so at 6 p.m. at Run Hub in Eugene, where we're going to have a little fun run from the shop. It's a 3 to 5 mile run for those capable. And then by 7 o'clock, we're going to kick over to Cold Fire and have an event, maybe a Q&A and a little discussion. And have a couple cold ones and talk about the front runner, and just celebrate this special person's life taken all too soon.
Brandon O'Meara is the author. The book is called The Life of Steve Prefontaine. It's titled The Front Runner. Brandon, thanks for joining us. I appreciate you, man.
This is a wonderful conversation, John. Thanks so much for your thoughtful questions. This was really a lot of fun.
There you go. Look, if you're interested in Steve Prefontaine, the book's called Front Runner. You can pre-order the book now. Mariner Books is the publisher. Comes out May 20th, 6 days from now. But I love getting to this stuff early. And certainly if you live in the state of Oregon, or you jog and you run, or you've got a kid in your family who runs, might not be a bad audiobook to pick up. You got the Bald-Faced Truth. Leave it here.